on the parameters of what I'm looking at. I'll try everything with the screwdriver. It's a $300 antenna. And by the way, with that antenna and this rig in the car in days of better propagation, I worked the world. So I know they both, the Kenwood 440 is a tank, and the screwdriver antenna is well built. So I'll take it from there. And one other thing, Dick, I'm talking on a Chinese radio I once gave a premature review of. This is the second radio. I blew the finals out of the first radio. But if you ever want if you ever have time for a review, I am now an expert in at least this Chinese radio. Thanks a lot, Dick, and everybody else. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
And cheerio, Dick, please.
Is that Chinese radio a Baofeng or a Waxan? W2BZ, K2IW?
It's a QYT, Queen Yankee Tango, a QYT 8900D. The thing is, if you look at a Baofeng, the lineup of Baofengs and other radios, it's the exact same radio, except with software. The software, I guess, is a little different. But I laugh when I see it under other, you know, labels and as big as Baofeng.
What's nice about this radio is it's got good sounding audio. The 5VR or whatever it is, series of radios these days, are using the new FCC mandate where the maximum deviation is 2.5 kc, and they've got very low audio when going through a repeater. So your particular Chinese radio, I know that some of them have got the full bandwidth of modulation. I wish somebody would go and measure the bandwidth of all of these various Chinese radios. And also a lot of the 5VRs, I think that they are. You'd be amazed how many of them are super narrow and give very little audio. Back to you for a final on that one, Rich, before I go over to EO. W2BZ, K2IW.
Well, very quickly, I for $79, I'm just going into a Home Depot little 2-meter vertical with one 19-inch rod pointing up at the top, which is only 10 feet off the ground or less, and one pointing down and the coax attached to it right into this radio. I'm making Selden and points west very, very well. The confounding thing is, and KC1SAM knows about this because he helped me with all my different signal reports, is the building, the peak of the building from Riverhead with this radio and hit a repeater with good audio reports. But I can't go 10 miles east to a repeater in Matatuck, which is really surprising. But anyway, for $79 to be able to get a signal out like this, at least into Selden and beyond, actually, I'm a happy camper, even though, like I said, this is my second one. Back to net, Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu.
Are you transmitting from Riverhead right now? Is that what you're saying, Rich?
I'm transmitting from Riverhead and hitting Selden. And like I said, it's just a chunk of PVC in the middle of a tree with one element going up and one element going down, coax attached to either side, coming right into this rig. That's it. That's the whole kit and caboodle. $79, and I am a happy camper.
And I presume you're going into the 975-375. You're going into the eastern input of Limehawk. Is that true?
Going into the Selden repeater.
Yeah, it sounds good. That's a good-sounding rig. It's got the right amount of audio. So I think you said $89. You're getting your money's worth. Tell me the model number and the brand name of that rig one more time.
The QYT. That's Queen Yankee Tango. QYT. 89 KT. Kilo Tango. KT-8900-DELTA, QYT-KT-8900-DELTA. The only problem with this radio is the software. If I were a high school teacher teaching the first visual basic course anybody ever learned, and they turned in software like this, they would fail the course. And I'm not kidding. They would fail the course. But if you know software a little bit, you know, and you learn it, you work with it long enough, you can get it to work very well. And, you know, I've spoken to people all over the country on the East Coast reflectors. repeater, which is 444.7. So I'm very happy with this radio as long as it keeps working.
Yeah, when it comes to the software or the way you program from the front panel on Baofeng and Waxongs, people are doing lots of complaining. So I guess the QYT is of the same vintage, the same kind of crazy programming of Baofeng and Waxong. You have reason to believe that's what's going on here, Rich, go ahead.
Dick, the program is so not current that, for instance, it asks you to confirm things. You don't need no confirmation. If you want to save your configuration file, it doesn't ask you if you're saving it with the same name, if you want to overwrite it. And things like that, that are so, all I can say, it's the sloppiest piece of software. I guess they just don't care. I guess they say, we're selling this for $79, let the person suffer with the software. But it is a high school, I would say, first semester final high school effort on the software.
Will it accept the so-called chirp program, where you can program it with a cord from your desktop computer? Over to you, Rich.
It would be impossible. The mic has a very nice keypad on it, but it would be impossible to program this radio through the keypad, through the menu on the keypad. So I only do it through a cord that, you know, a cord that's attached to my computer. Yes, and it will take chirp. The problem with chirp is when you're writing, there's two parts to the software for this radio. Chirp only has one part of them, but the most important part, which is basically a spreadsheet of frequencies and offsets, you know, that you want to download into the radio. The problem with chirp is the download time. Once you type in all the repeaters and the offsets and whatever, and the names of them, it takes maybe 3 or 4 minutes. If you only have two repeaters, typed into the spreadsheet-like software, it'll take 5 minutes to download because it's downloading 1,000 channels. This radio takes maybe 1 minute to download, no matter whether you have 100 repeaters programmed in or 2 repeaters programmed in. But what Chirp doesn't have that this radio does have is there are other functions like the color of the screen and the squelch, and you know, a myriad of other functions that is the second part of the program. And the great thing about that, the download time, if I want to change the color of the screen from green to red, and I want to then download that or upload that, I mean, into the radio, it's under 15 seconds. And that part of it's a joy. But the way you have to get around stuff is pretty mind-boggling. I don't understand how they can make so many mistakes in best practices and not care and not improve it. I just don't get it. Because I know they're selling a lot of these radios between Baofeng and the rest of them. It's the same radio, Dick, W2BZ.
Interesting. But at least we now know another brand name, the model number, that's got full modulation, doesn't have this super narrow jazz. Okay, Rich N2EO wants to give us some info. N2EO, KQI, are you good, Rich?
Okay, Dick, N2EO. Most hams are not aware of this, it's very surprising. There's a bill up in Congress called the Parity Act. It means parity between hams and non-hams. The Parity Act says that people in co-ops and condos will legally have a right to put up antennas. Nobody can say that it's ugly, unsightly. They won't buy it. Government realizes how helpful hams are in crisis. There was a bill up before the Parity Act. Almost made it in committee. It was shot down by one guy, a congressman or a senator in Florida. just because he was heavily involved with condos in Florida. We would have a lot of them. The dollar bill was reintroduced in the Poverty Act. And Trump, I understand, is willing to sign it. I guess I called my congressman's office. They told me I'm in the second congressional district. That's a guy named Peter King. They told me Peter King is on board with it, and so is the president. That's a good thing. Over to you, Dick.
Very fine with that information, Rich. And W2BZ, I was hearing you simultaneously coming out of 975-375. You want to repeat your last transmission, Rich, number two?
Sorry. I just said with the aging population, ham radio population, and a lot of us moving into co-ops, selling our homes. I mean, the last time I had a home, I had a full-wave 80-meter loop up, and I didn't have any problems like I'm having now. But this problem, this condo problem, the housing association problem, is a big one across this country. As I sweep YouTube and dig down into YouTube, what a resource. It's a living encyclopedia, you know, to find ideas for antennas, HF antennas here. You just see how big a problem this condo, no antenna, no anything problem is across the country, if not across the world, with the aging ham population.
AT2GS?
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a little bit. The Parity Act is not particularly about co-ops or apartment houses. They're about homeowners associations. It was brought to Congress for two congressional sessions. Those are two-year segments. And the first time it didn't get out of committee. The second time it got out of committee in the Congress, but it was shut down by the Florida senator who lost his reelection bid. It's not up this year at all, and the ARRL has pretty much issued a statement saying that we would like the Congress to kind of slow it down and let them reassess what the Parity Act means, and the congressman doesn't have that much power anymore. So I'm not very optimistic about it, but it probably wasn't terribly useful because there were a lot of loopholes. Probably it was a lawyer's best friend.
Barry Goldwater.
Yeah, we need Barry. And we need Mr. Kennedy in Massachusetts and so on. And we need McCain from Arizona. Oh, well. Let's see. Next guy on my list is good old Joe. W2LYY. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Joe. K2LIW. Maybe Joe can't stay up this late because he's got to get up pretty early in the morning. Okay. So one other thing I was going to mention to you guys is that if you take the latest issue of Microwave Product Digest, MPD, there's an article in there about the fact that we're now tooling up for the fifth generation of cell phone hardware, which gives you certain increases in upload and download speed and so on. Believe it or not, the FCC has already made decisions on the sixth generation, 6G. They've made decisions where you're going to be using 95 gigs up to 5 terahertz frequencies to get even greater bandwidth and greater hardware. So they've already defined the next stage of developing cell phones. Wild. And we're, I think they've only done 5% of the installation of 5G so far. Okay, the next person who's going to be giving us some interesting information tonight is Roy, Dr. Roy AC2GS, with his talk and other things. So he's got some nice puzzles and whatever. And over to you, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and nice to be back after a couple of weeks off. As always, I like to tell people, if you have a topic, if you have a question, if you have a comment, if you want to just email me,
The email address would be mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, everything that I talk about, I will have links up on a web page, and the web page is roy.ac2gs.com, and I have an image already up that people might want to take a look at, because it'll be of the basis for a little conversation. And we do still have that chat room, and the easiest way to get at it is just to type chat.ac2gs.com if you want to talk a spell when I'm not actually doing this. So let me drop for a second, and then I will go on with the show. Okay, if you take a gander at roy.ac2gs.com, you'll see a very nice picture. It's not very sharp, but it's beautiful nevertheless. As you no doubt have seen and read about in the news, it is the result of a lot of number crunching involved in the data from radio telescopes all over the world focused on a single point in our sky, the very center of the galaxy M87, also known as Virgo A or NGC 4486, where we have believed that an enormous black hole is located. This project also captured a less informative second image of our more humble black hole at the center of our own Milky Way galaxy, Sagittarius A star. Now, although Sagittarius A star is a lot closer, it's also a lot less massive. It's less than 3 million times the mass of our sun and has a lot of star stuff fluttering its images past to us. Keep in mind that the center of M87 is approximately 55 million light years away from us. In units of miles, if you like those things, that's a 3 followed by 20 zeros after it. Now that's a heck of a lot of miles. Let me drop for a second. Anyway, the black hole at the center of M87 has been calculated to be somewhere around 6.5 billion times the mass of our sun. We can predict the approximate size of its event horizon by that, and in the image you can see that it is much larger than our solar system. The image that I have up kind of has a little drawing of our little solar system with the sun and Pluto and where Voyager would have been in relation to the enormous size of the event horizon. Anyway, to get an idea of how small M87's black hole would appear to us here on the Earth, consider the idea of what's called angular size. The Moon, viewed from the Earth, takes up about 0.52 degrees of angular size. Each degree can be divided into 60 arc minutes per degree, and those arc minutes can be further divided into 60 arc seconds per arc minute, but even arc seconds are too large a unit to describe the angular size of the event horizon of M87's black hole from here on Earth. Something like 3.8 micro arc seconds, millionths of a single arc second. It's akin to trying to see someone holding a orange on the surface of the Moon. No single telescope on Earth could even hope to resolve an image with such an infinitesimally small angular size. You would need a microscope as large as the Earth itself, or something almost as good. Enter the concept of very large baseline interferometry. An example of this technology, the Very Large Baseline Array, is a network of 10 observing radio telescopes located across the United States, receiving distant radio signals 0.3 to 96.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Oh, well, in case you missed it, the previous design had a range of 0.3 gigahertz to 96 gigahertz. Anyway, the Very Large Baseline Array acts like a really big radio telescope, but it isn't big enough, and it isn't listening at the right frequency for black hole spotting. Now, as I said, you would need a radio telescope almost as large as the Earth itself, and at the very large arrays, band range, the radio signals from the accretion disk surrounding the black hole would scatter way too much to see anything useful. So was born the idea of the Event Horizon Telescope Project. This is based upon very large baseline interferometry, but it involves a multinational cooperation using radio telescopes located all over the Earth, able to detect signals as high as 230 gigahertz and combine the data as though it was received by a single radio telescope almost as large as the Earth. And that is how we got our beautiful picture. It doesn't mean that if you took something a lot faster than, say, Starfleet's Enterprise all the way to M87 and looked at it yourself, you'd see anything similar to that orange halo, as shown in the image. This image is the result of a lot of number crunching of radio frequency emissions detected by many radio telescopes all over the Earth. And as we all know, radio waves, even microwaves, aren't colored orange. Let me drop for a sec. Like a lot of NASA's imagery, they have used false colors to demonstrate the radio wave emission so that you'll be able to perceive and get a good sense of what's going on. As beautiful as this image is, it's more than a bit blurry due to the radio wave scattering from free electrons scattered throughout space itself. These radio waves are generated by the intense gravitational fields that the surrounding accretion disk of gas and dust. What about Hawking's radiation, you ask? Well, sorry, but confusing as it may be, the larger the black hole, the lower the energy of its Hawking radiation. For a black hole like the one at the center of M87, it's emitting the equivalent of black body radiation of an object that's approximately 2.5 times 10 to the minus 20 degree Kelvin. That's very, very cold. With a peak frequency emission somewhere in the billions of a hertz. Now, some people might be annoyed that they promised pictures of a black hole, not an accretion disk, but try to take a picture of a shadow, a local absence of illumination. The event horizon of a black hole is probably the ultimate shadow. Let me drop for a sec. Anyway, the dim center in the image is its event horizon. You can think of it, of an event horizon as an ink black sphere. But its angular momentum and it's given by spin does distort it into a somewhat oblate spheroid, you know, like the Earth is an oblate spheroid. So, when you look at the central area, you are looking at the black hole's event horizon. Now, we once discussed how much a celestial object can truly be seen at one time in a given distance. The idea was that as an object got farther and farther away, your total view would get closer and closer to seeing 50% of the celestial object. It would have to be infinitely far away to see exactly 50% at one single time. So, I have a puzzle for you guys tonight. How much of M87's black hole event horizon do you think is observable in these images? Anyone want to guess? 0, 50, 49.99999999? Any guesses? Yes, what's your guess? Okay, we have a 49.99999 into infinity. We have 50%. Does anyone else have any thoughts on the subject whatsoever? I give you guys 2 weeks off and you lose the habit of participating here. Come on. You know, think a little bit. You know, if it was obvious, obviously I probably would ask you this question. So think if there's a trick to it all.
VDH with a comic?
John.
I'm going to say something greater than 50% due to the fact that, well, any possible emissions from behind it may be bent around it. Go ahead.
That's very good. So, do you want to give an approximate number or just leave it as greater than 50%?
I'll say something like 75%. I know, like, when a star passes behind a black hole, it appears as a ring where the light is deflected to all sides at once. So based on that, I'm going to say 75%.
Okay, John, that's a perfectly good answer. Does anyone else have any thoughts on the subject?
WS.
Yes, Paul.
I don't know, I'm going to go with a lower number, because what we're looking at is, you know, what we're seeing, you know, what looks like the equator for that area. And, what you know, it's really a sphere, what exists. If you were to go, like, 90 degrees, you know, above the surface of that from where we are now, you would probably still see the same thing. I'm going to go with a small number, like 10%.
Okay, 10%, 49.99, 50%, and 75%. Anyone else with any thoughts on the subject? Well, black holes are curious things that warp the very fabric of space-time, so much so that the emissions we detected are subject to a great deal of gravitational lensing distortion, as John mentioned. The event horizon we're seeing is, in fact, 100% of all of it, with distorted copies that are layered in larger and larger radii outward from its center. So it's multiple kind of echoes of itself in thinner, more warped slices going farther and farther out. So in a way, you could say that you're detecting almost an infinite percent of the surface of the event horizon. As I said before, they have very curious things. Let me drop for a sec. Now, you also might wonder why there seems to be a lack of symmetry in the emissions illustrated in the picture. To a degree, this possibly is partially due to it not being in the perfect place to image the accretion disk's emissions. But there's a much more interesting factor involved. There is something that's called relativistic beaming, sometimes called relativistic Doppler beaming. I'll spare you the math, but effectively a particle emitting radiation that is traveling towards you at near relativistic speed appears with a higher intensity than the radiated emissions of a particle traveling away from you at a near relativistic speed. So, in other words, the particles are racing around the event horizon. The brighter parts of the halo that you see are from particles moving towards you, and the dimmer parts are from particles traveling away from you at the given time. Now, what plans do the people behind the Event Horizon Telescope Project have for the future? Well, they would really like to get the radio telescope's receiving band up from its present 230 gigahertz to something like 345 gigahertz. They believe that this will diminish the scattering of the signal and improve the resolution by a factor of 1.5 for an object like M87, and by a factor of 2.0 for a Sagittarius A star. They also would like to look at other black holes in our cosmos, and they're considering taking a series of daily images, and after collecting a year's worth of them, stringing them together into a very, very short video. So that's my little thing on our black hole. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2 GF.
P2 Bravo Zulu with a question.
Yes, Rich.
How do they determine the frequencies they're going to shoot at this stuff?
Not quite sure what the question is. How did they figure out what frequency they were going to use to detect the emissions from the event horizon? Is that the question?
Or any deep space objects, how do they figure out the optimal frequencies?
Well, it's kind of trial and error. They have radio telescopes. Again, most of the radio telescopes around operate at lower frequencies. They go up to about 96 gigahertz, but they've been testing and trying to use higher frequencies, and they've been able to collect, there are 8 radio telescopes involved in the Event Horizon Telescope Project, and they were able to get them all up in specs to be much higher in frequency. The higher is usually the better, so 230 gigahertz is what they settled on. It would work even better, they believe, if they could get all these radio telescopes up to a higher frequency, because the scatter from free electrons in space diminishes as the destructive. Radio frequencies seem to have the best way of getting past them into our receivers.
Were all the telescopes around the world on the exact same frequency?
Yeah, they agreed upon it. It would kind of make a mishmash. If it was on a lower frequency, they would get too much scatter, and their image wouldn't be worth number crunching. So they all had to agree upon 230 gigahertz. It was 8 telescopes for the most part. They did the imaging over a 10-day period in April of 2017. During one half of the day, Sagittarius A star was in view. The other 12 hours, M87 was in view. The problem, though, was that M87 is a northern star, so the radio telescope in the South Pole couldn't be used, so they only used 7 of the 8 radio telescopes for M87.
Last question. What's preventing them from going higher in frequency? Is it just radio design?
It's purely engineering. It requires a little bit more finesse to bring up the frequencies. And ultimately, these high frequencies at this time are only particularly well-suited for seeing event horizons. And although it made the news and everyone was thrilled, to invest in a lot of radio telescopes, after a while, they're going to want to do something different with them that they don't really know if raising up the frequency range is going to benefit other studies. But they'll experiment with that as well. So, yeah, it's more of an engineering and an investment problem than it is anything else.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I don't know if you have a list of the telescopes. Maybe I'll send that to you. You might want to put that on your website, Roy. But they use the ALMA, the one in Chile. You know, that's the Atacama large millimeter array, and they use the a couple of them in the Atacama Chile area. But they also use another one in Spain, another one in Hawaii. Another one down in Mexico, and then Hawaii, also Antarctica. So, now, there was a good documentary on, I don't know if anybody gets the Smithsonian station, but they had a good documentary on that, and it's still, up on the, if you get free on demand, and if you put in the Black Hole Hunter as a search, that should come up if you get that station. And it was good, I think it was on for 1 hour, and they really did a lot of good explanation. Let me drop it. And it really showed what these people went through all across the world, and they had to coordinate the exact same time to do it. And they hit a little bit on the interferometry. One part of the globe will receive the signal before the other one, because the Earth is curved, and they showed that, and what's involved with the timing and the computers. And for some reason, they had to send it to 2 different computer locations. They would take all the hard drives out of these antennas and send them away to Germany and also another place in Massachusetts, and they would coordinate. They showed all that. So they had to wait a long time, before they got results on whether or not they even got an image. That was pretty good. Also, the timing, apparently there's some kind of a deal with the computers. They need their exact frequency, to figure out the difference between the signals. So the higher the frequency, the higher it is, the harder it is to get this computer to figure the exact number. It has to be on the right amount of, right amount of hertz. They go into the gigahertz up all the way up into the petahertz, some extremely high number. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, thanks a lot, Paul. There is so much material available. Anyone really interested should do a Google search. I'm going to post a couple of Veritasium YouTube videos that go into it, but there's a lot of talk. There's the Harvard postdoc student who kind of was deeply involved in this. There's a lot of material out there. They sent the computer tape both to MIT in Massachusetts and to Germany. They used a very interesting atomic clock. They didn't use any of the atomic clocks that we really talked about earlier this year, the cesium, the rubidium. They used a hydrogen gas maser, which is accurate to billions of years. It loses less than a second. They needed that perfect timing in order to coordinate all of the readings from the eight telescopes and make sense of it. If it was off by a fraction of a second, it really caused a deterioration of the final result. It's a fascinating subject. There's a lot of little nooks and crannies that are just as fascinating. So it's probably one of the big things that happened this year, although it happened in 2017. They crunched the numbers for a long time. The funny thing is, in Antarctica, although they really couldn't use it for M87, they used it for Sagittarius A star, there were months before they could ship the hard drives out just because of the weather problem. So it was kind of difficult dealing with those things. There was a lot of engineering and a lot of management problems getting everything right for this. But it was a great experiment. Okay, anyone else with any questions or anything about the black hole, the Event Horizon Telescope or black holes, or otherwise I guess I'll move on to the next story.
Where did you get that picture with the reference with Pluto and the Sun and Voyage 1 in it?
Favorite cartoon site called XKCD. He's a bit of an engineer cartoonist, and he does a lot on science. And, I just find his stuff amusing as heck. And this is a nice little example of it where he kind of scrolled a little cartoon version of our solar system inside the event horizon hole of this image. I thought it kind of adds something a little bit more than the usual image that everyone is looking at of the event horizon telescope's illustration.
Oh yeah, very well done.
Okay, I mean, hopefully in a year or two or three, we'll be talking about the moving video of the Event Horizon, the accretion disk going round and round, because that's what they hope to be able to do in the near future. As I said before, this particular project was done over a 10-day period. They took, back in April, they decided would be the best kind of general weather period for something. The end of March, beginning of April, they took 12 hours apiece between Sagittarius A star and M87, and then they collated all the data and just came out with the info, a couple weeks ago. So it took them almost 2 years from the time that they took the data to the number crunching to double checking themselves and giving it all to us to see. Okay, on with the next. The scientists have long suspected that around 100,000 years after the Big Bang, helium and hydrogen combined to form the first molecule, helium hydride. That helped the universe begin to cool and led to the formation of stars. But despite decades of searching, scientists could never actually locate helium hydride in space until now. NASA used its Strategic Observatory for Infrared Astronomy to detect the primordial molecule. The scientists found it in NGC 7027, a planetary nebula, a remnant of a sun-like star, located 3,000 light years away. The discovery proves that helium hydride can exist in space and it confirms theories about the chemistry of the early universe and its evolution. The findings were published recently in the... the discovery is also a testament to the power of NASA's latest technology, the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. Is the world's largest airborne observatory. It's a modified Boeing 747ST jetliner, and it returns after every flight. That allows NASA to add new tools as they're available. Recent upgrade to the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy was the German receiver at terahertz frequency, called GREAT, made this discovery. Scientists were able to tune to the frequency of this particular molecule and search for it in NGC 7027, where they've expected it could exist since the 1970s. Let me drop for any comments or questions. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, if anybody looks up Sophia on the computer, you know, it puts in that Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy. You can see this telescope sticking out of the back side of the 747, and it's the same diameter as Hubble. It's roughly about 8 feet in diameter, so it's pretty amazing. So that's what they've been using for quite a few years. I think once in a while they have to bring the plane in for service. You know, the plane might be down for 6 months or so, but out of the rest of the years, the thing has been flying on a regular basis. Interesting place if you bring it up.
Okay, I will have a link to this as well in the article, and hopefully they will. I don't recall if they have an image of the Sophia device. They might. I just don't remember. And that reminds me, you mentioned Hubble. I was talking about the angular size of the M87 event horizon was something like 4 micro arc seconds. Hubble, the tiniest thing the resolution for Hubble can see is approximately 50,000 micro arc seconds. So you can imagine how difficult it would be for something even like Hubble to be able to view the event horizon at.
I like some of the examples they give. I like the one that you were talking about, the orange on the moon. And the one I saw was reading a newspaper from New York, if the paper is in Los Angeles. Back to you, Roy.
It's nice when people develop these common sense analogies. You don't have to go around with equations and such. You put it in kind of a real life perceivable analogy. So I always kind of try and look for those things and use them if I can possibly do so.
Roy, what is the formula for helium hydride?
I believe it is HEH. It's one atom of each.
Thank you.
Going to see much of it here on the Earth, thankfully. It's a highly unstable, dubious, because helium is a noble gas. It usually doesn't want to bond, but as long as it's only usually and not never, you can find it out there, thankfully.
Roy, I get another question, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
It's supposed to be a gas, or maybe it's a liquid. It sounds like the same thing. It might not be, though. I know they're looking for it. And what it is this, they're looking for the link between chemistry and biology. You know, there's some kind of hydrogen and something or other. I don't know if this is stuff or not. And they figured out that they need it for, you know, to make that jump to create, let's say, RNA from just regular molecules. And I wonder if this is the stuff that they were looking for, or maybe I'm thinking of a different chemical. But, you know, it's one of these elusive things. They just need more of it, and there's no way in the world there could be enough on Earth to have it. They already figured out that if you take the stuff and hit it with an asteroid, you get enough energy out of it to mix these atoms so that they become RNA. This might be the stuff, but I'm not sure. Back to you, Roy.
I can't tell you much about that because I'm not quite sure what that is. I would assume it is not helium hydride. Helium hydride would just kind of very quickly dissociate into hydrogen gas and helium gas and not spark any life. You know, life is basically just glorified organic chemistry, which is not really about living things per se, but about carbon-containing things, because most carbon-containing things, with the exception of cyanide and carbon dioxide, is called organic chemistry. And you just put enough hydrogen and carbon and occasionally a sulfur and some oxygen, and you build on those things. So chemistry and biology are aspects of the same thing. It's like physics as well. Most science is just the other side of a coin. It's all one big glop of stuff that works through different ways than looking at it. Chemistry primarily is more the study of how valence electrons interact that give us what we call chemical reactions and molecules and atoms and interactions like that, whereas physics gets a little bit more esoteric and wants to talk more about the nuclear aspects of the atom. But, you know, chemistry, physics, biology, it's all one wonderful thing.
Okay, very good. It was on another documentary that I do not have saved, so I can't go back. But at the time, I remember they were talking about this stuff, and you know, they could figure out how all the atoms got started from the Big Bang, and they, you know, the first stars and everything. But how do you get from you know, the you know, after you wind up with oxygen and carbon and this and that, you know, how do you turn this into RNA? And they figured they need this chemical or whatever it was, and it sounded sort of like this name, but I guess it's not. Back to you, Ron.
Okay, I'll do a little searching on it. As Dick knows, Stanley Miller and I forget the other guy's name, unfortunately, found that if you just put the regular things into a flask and give it a little bit of electroshock, these things kind of coalesce into all kinds of interesting organic chemistry. And as far as where the carbon and the oxygen and such came from the core of exploding suns, you know, we've probably gone through about three generations of stars before our present star shine in the sky. So all those previous suns exploding have spread out all these more complicated atoms that coalesced and settled into planets and that developed water and got dissolved in water and a couple of lightning bolts. And although some people think that it might be some asteroid came by to seed the planet, is theory. Yes, Wesley.
I'm a little confused when you said it comes from sun. Carbon comes from triple alpha process that occurs in cores of giant stars, or supergiant stars. What sun has to do with it?
I'm exactly sure what you're asking, if you could restate it.
From what you said that carbon came from sun, and that was a nature of my confusion.
Oh, that's my understanding. The Big Bang basically mostly generated a lot of hydrogen and helium. What then had to take place was the hydrogen had to coalesce into star-like objects that furiously burnt using fusion, fusing lighter hydrogen to helium and helium to heavier and heavier and heavier, And depending upon the size and the heat of the star before it became unstable and exploded, it was full of all kinds of goodies going all the way to iron. If you have to synthesize anything heavier than iron, you need a a supernova to kind of get it over that hump, because fusion by itself is only going to get you to iron. But I don't know, you have a different belief of where oxygen and carbon was created?
For me, son, it's too small for being a depository of carbon. It is a giant or supergiant stars that are responsible for it. And the triple collision of helium nuclei, and that is because there were certain conditions required that happened during the creation of the universe, and carbon was made by after the Big Bang. In a micro word, carbon in both coals and oils come from flora and fauna, and from plants and to actually.
Okay, Wes, we're just having a semantic argument at this point, because I sort of was sloppy in my word usage. I kind of used sun and star interchangeable. Obviously, carbon didn't come from our sun, because our sun is up there still. It came from stars. If you want to be ultimately accurate, it came from stars. They usually have to be larger than our present sun in order to be able to fuse elements down to oxygen and carbon, but the principle is still the same. And as far as organic chemistry, although it began with the study of compounds that are associated with life, as far as 150 years ago, chemists were able to synthesize organic compounds without going through any living organisms. So it has historical basis in living organisms, but now it's basically just any carbon compound other than a few particular carbon compounds that for historical reasons are placed to the side.
The reason I focus on it is that I've got my new electron microscope 2 weeks ago. And this one is from boron to uranium, as previous GDXRF was only from sodium to uranium. So now carbon 12, 13, and 14 is not a problem. And I'm kind of in focus in this direction. Andrew here.
Okay, very good. An electron microscope. That's a heck of a toy.
Yeah, that's LEO, LEO, 435 VP, variable pressure, Swiss, made in Switzerland, but actually it does have the causate. Leo is owned by Carzate, so we could say it's Carzate. And Oxford is making EDXRF for it. But it gives me not only EDXRF, but also wave. Dispersive spectroscopy, not only energy in dispersive spectroscopy. So this is something sitting in the basement and working on it right now. It came from university and direction.
I hope you have a lot of fun with it, and maybe you should do a YouTube video with it.
I'm still working on it. There are two modules, and this thing is $228,000. I don't want to read anything. And it enters here.
Okay, very good, Wes. Anyone with any further questions or comments, or I'll move on to the next item. Okay, I don't know if everyone is familiar with a dish called a turducken. It's a duck stuffed with a chicken, which is then used to stuff a turkey. Well, astronomers apparently have found an astronomical equivalent for that. Scientists have found a cometary building block in an unexpected place, deep inside a meteorite, according to a new paper. The researchers report finding a 0.1 millimeter carbon-rich rock fragment inside of a meteorite. They interpreted it as a piece of comet captured during the earliest ages of the solar system, when the planets were still forming and later brought to the Earth. Simply don't have a lot of comet samples here on Earth to study, which makes this a potentially discovery very exciting. The fragments may be characteristic of cometary materials that are not represented in meteorite collections because they're too fragile to survive atmospheric entry, according to a paper published recently in Nature Astronomy. A meteorite is a rock from space that's already landed on the surface of the Earth. It could be a part of an asteroid, a rocky body thought to originate from leftover matter in the solar system that didn't form into planets or parts of comets, which are similar to asteroids, but contain volatile elements that heat in the atmosphere, called a coma and a tail under the influence of the sun. These are clunky terms, but they get at what astronomers are interested in more generally, how the solar system formed and how the different objects we see today can retell that story. Let me drop for a second. The researchers analyzed a meteorite from Antarctica called LAT-02342, which is interesting because it's been minimally weathered or eroded during its time on the Earth. They analyzed it with an electron microscope, revealing the tiny carbon-rich section that differed from the rest of the otherwise typical meteorite. Its composition matched other interplanetary dust particles astronomers had previously argued come from comets. Humans weren't around to watch the meteorite form, so we can't determine the exact origin of this fragment. But the researchers have some ideas. Maybe it was the earliest stage of a comet forming from material in the outermost region of the solar system, perhaps the icy Kuiper belt. But the comet's formation was somehow stopped, and this piece was snatched up by an asteroid which moved inward towards the sun and eventually struck our Earth. Hopefully, scientists will soon find more of these carbon specks inside asteroids to tell the solar system's origin story further. According to the paper, dedicated researchers for these carbon-rich pieces in meteorites may prove valuable for expanding our understanding of the full range of primitive astromaterials in the early solar system. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, no questions about the turducken. Less than 2 weeks after the gravitational wave detectors were turned back on, they've already seen evidence of two pairs of colliding black holes. Scientists are no longer hoping just to discover gravitational waves, the ripples through space first predicted by Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity. Since they first detected the waves in 2015, they've progressed to using large data sets of the events that produce the waves, typically black holes slamming together, to solve the mysteries of our universe more generally. The two gravitational wave detectors, LIGO in the U.S. and Virgo in Italy, were shut down during the summer of 2017 to improve their sensitivity. The upgraded detectors were turned back on April 1st, the beginning of their third observational run. In these jaded days of gravitational wave detectors, black hole mergers are routine. But the first 2 weeks of the observing run demonstrate just how routine they've become. Though things were quiet for the first week, the second week has already brought a pair of presumed gravitational wave signals. A pair of detectors in the U.S. called the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, LIGO, only discovered their first gravitational wave in 2015. The results of a pair of black holes, 1.3 billion light-years away, slamming together. Since then, the European Virgo experiment has come online, and astronomers have now recorded 10 black hole mergers and one pair of smaller objects called neutron stars colliding. Let me drop for a second. Specific Obviously, scientists have sent out alerts to other telescopes about a pair of high-probability events. Those telescopes can then hunt for counterparts in the light waves to match the signal picked up by the gravitational wave detector. They seem to be the real deal. They've passed our initial checks that the detectors were behaving. We're now doing more careful checks and will perform more thorough analysis to work out their properties, end quote. You might wonder why they're already hearing about these